Okay, now we're talking about this uniqueness proof, so let me get back to the text here. I went a little bit ahead of myself, so let me give you Bahnsen's take on this. Bahnsen's comeback to this type of criticism is that the following. He says something like this in his book, Van Til's Apologetic. Suppose a basketball player, Michael Jordan, beats every worthy opponent in a one-to-one basketball game. He can justifiably claim to be the best individual basketball player in the world. Suppose further that another jealous and peevish basketball player, who was previously trounced by Jordan, resents that he, Jordan, has titled himself the best player in the world. His comeback is, just because you have beat every current player does not mean that there is not another one coming who is better than you. Jordan's response can be anticipated. What is it? Bring him on, right? Bring him on. I'm waiting. I'm standing right here. I'm not running. The theoretical possibility that there may be another player better than Jordan is not a concern to him. In the world of basketball, it is the one who is actually the best player and not who is possibly the best player. That is, that's what's of importance, who is actually, not who is possibly. In the practice of apologetics, things are similar. What matters are actual worldviews, not possible worldviews. So this is one of Bahnsen's comebacks to Montgomery. So again, the analogy is, I beat as the only one who beat Michael Jordan. Remember, I'm a future center NBA player. I beat Michael Jordan 1-on-1, and every other player 1-on-1. And I claim I'm the best basketball player in the world. And then we have Chris Driebel, after I trounced him. He's not in here. Actually, don't tell him this, but he can beat me pretty handily. But I don't ever tell about him directly, because I always have an off day when I play him. So I say to Chris, says after I bruised his ego, he says to me, well, there's somebody that could beat you. It's possible. And my answer is, bring him on, right? Who is he? Right? It's not enough for you to say there may be. Give me him. Okay, so Bahnsen answers it this way. Now, Bahnsen's second answer is, well, the criticism is no practical value. I'm sorry. Right, so Bahnsen is showing here that this criticism has no practical value. Right, no practical value. If we go and have a debate like Greg Bahnsen did between the Muslim, the Jew, and the Christian, and Bahnsen beats up and shows that the Islamic and the Judaic worldview is nonsense, right, it's not enough for them to say, well, there may be something out there that can beat you. Right, that's not going to forward them at all. It's not going to bring any comfort to them. By the way, now that I mentioned that, one thing is interesting. I was not there at that debate, but my friend Tim Harris was there, and this was in Southern California. He debated, Greg debated, a rabbi and a Muslim. And in the course of the debate, one thing was very interesting that doesn't come through on the tape. This is recorded, but it doesn't come through on the recording. Because one of the things that Greg Bahnsen said is that you keep your hands off of my children, you religionists. You keep your hands off of my religion. And the Muslim and the rabbi came back and says, well, you keep your hands off of our children. And they were offended by Greg because Greg showed them that both of their religions were not only false, but they needed to become Christian. And he was, as you all know, very forceful at it. Now, at the end of the debate, what was telling is that the rabbi and the Muslim made a statement that was very, very telling. They stood up, extended their hands to each other, and shook each other's hand vigorously. The Muslim and the Jew, aren't they haters of each other? Shaking hands like this. Now, Greg walked up to both of them and put his hand out, and they both ignored him. They wouldn't shake his hand. Oh, isn't that interesting? They're willing to take common cause against a common enemy. They see that the enemy is that man standing right there and what he represents. They're not going to shake his hand. And they're willing to put their otherwise big disagreements aside to make a public display that they are not going to have anything to do with what that man represents. Very interesting. Okay, another reason that we should not be impressed by the so-called Judeo-Christian tradition. Okay, the Jews have much more in common with Muslims. They are the same thing at the core, standing over against Christianity. Okay, the criticism that Bronson gives here is a practical criticism that shows that the appeal to a bare possibility is of no practical value. Just because somebody claims that there may be something, big deal. It's of no practical value. So while the criticism is no practical value, it would be nevertheless a serious criticism of TAG if correct. Right? Because we're not just claiming that we can beat everybody that's standing up. We claim that we beat everybody. There is no possible worldview out there that can defeat Christianity or that can make sense of the human experience. If there are an infinite number of worldviews and TAG only refutes a slice of them, then it has not established that Christianity is the necessary precondition of human intelligibility. Even granting that TAG demonstrates the absurdity of all actual worldviews, it does not follow that all possible worldviews are likewise absurd. Bronson's comeback is to place the one who makes this move on the horns of the dilemma, or a trilemma. It's actually three prongs to this. The unbeliever, and I'll quote him here, unbeliever either implicitly assumes the Christian's presuppositions, in which case he loses, right? Two, he considers it a mystery that not everything is mysterious or nonsensical, right? There may be no worldview out there that makes sense of things, but we, in some ways, make sense of things. It's a mystery. Or, three, offers a worldview in which words and reasoning are meaningful. On one, the imaginary opponent loses the debate. On three, the Christian proceeds to refute the proffered worldview, right? There is something out there. We'll show it to us. Let's defeat it. As for two, Bronson contends that this is tantamount to acknowledging defeat. He then considers the possibility of one making a blind leap of faith, one who holds out the hope of that someday, somewhere, someone will furnish an adequate, autonomous worldview to protect unbelievers against the compelling rationality of Christianity. That's a quote from Bronson. Unquote. This, he says, is identical with two, and since this is an acknowledgement of defeat, the opponent loses the debate. There's a problem with this defense, however. The notions of losing a debate and conceding defeat trade on an ambiguity. In this context, these notions can mean one of two things. They can mean that since the opponent resorts to mere rhetorical possibility, theoretical possibility, he has conceded that he cannot produce a worldview to compete with Christianity. He is thus defeated in the sense that he can offer no account for human experience. Taken this way, Bronson is right. Second, these notions can mean that this move is philosophically illegitimate because appeals to mere theoretical possibilities are of no significance when establishing the claims that something is a necessary precondition of something else. Taken this way, I don't think Bronson is correct. Don't strike me down. I don't think he's right about this, though. Winning the debate and proving that Christianity is the necessary precondition of human experience are two different things. Okay, so Greg goes so far, and I think he's missing the theoretical aspect of it. Yes, it's of no practical value, this objection. Maybe there's something out there. But theoretically, that is an objection, right? We're claiming there's no possible worldview other than Christianity that can explain human experience. Now, if we decimate all known worldviews, that does not mean we've established Christianity. There may be some unknown worldviews. However, Bronson comes back and makes a further point that this criticism misses the thrust of TAG altogether. TAG argues for the impossibility of the contrary and not the impossibility of an infinite number of possible worldviews. TAG does not establish the necessity of Christianity by inductively refuting each and every possible non-Christian worldview, but rather contends that the contrary of Christianity, any view that denies the Christian view of God, is shown to be impossible. And if the negation of Christianity is false, Christianity is proved true. We covered this ground already. In other words, the structure of the argument is a disjunctive syllogism, right? Which is what? Something like A or not A, not A, Right? It's not the Christian, non-Christian worldview, not non-A, therefore A. At this point, the clever opponent will deny the first premise. He will contend that it should not be constructed as a disjunction of a contradiction, but a simple disjunction. The argument should thus be restated along the following lines. A or B, not B, therefore A. And since this move is made, he will then contend that while the argument is valid, the first premise involves a false dilemma. That is, he will grant that given A or B, and the negation of B, A does indeed follow, but nevertheless maintain that the argument is unsound because the first premise, A or B, is not true. The reason is that there are more possibilities than just A and B. Given the true first premise, A or B or C or D, dot, 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 on to N, whatever N is, the negation of B merely entails that A, along with the disjunction of the propositions besides B, C, D, all the way to N, follows. Okay, I don't know how much you follow that. Let me explain it to you. To come back to this argument that Bonson gives and I've been giving is that, look, you're claiming that it is A or not A, right? And since you proved not A, A is the Christian worldview, not A is the negation of the Christian worldview, you proved not A, then you proved what? A, right? Now, nobody can say anything against this as a perfectly valid argument. But the opponent of TAG may say, well, this is not the right construction of it. This is an unsound construction because the first premise is false. What really is going on is it's A or B, not B, therefore what? A. Another valid argument. But the contention is, though this argument is also valid, and indeed may be sound, it doesn't establish Christianity. Because A and B are not the only possibilities. Think of it this way. A is Christianity, B is Buddhism. You disprove Buddhism, you prove Christianity. Now the objector at this point says, no. You haven't disproved Christianity, or you haven't proved Christianity. You have disprove Buddhism and Christianity and the conjunction of other possible worldviews. So Islam, Hinduism, etc., right? A, C, D, all the way to N, whatever N is, however many worldviews you want to consider. So this is the way it really should be set up. In order for this argument to be successful, it is incumbent upon the opponent of TAG to defend two claims, though, in order for this to work. He has to defend two claims. First, he must defend the contention that the original first premise is not the disjunction of the contradiction. This is our claim. When we disprove a version of the non-Christian worldview, we disprove the non-Christian worldview. He has to show that this is not, the first premise is not the disjunction of a contradiction, of contradictory premises, but rather something like this. Second, he must show that there are other possible disjunctions besides B. Excuse me, that's a mistake. It should be disjuncts besides B. Typo here. What we can call the view that is opposed to the Christian worldview. Since, as far as I'm aware, there is nothing in the literature on TAG that defend either of these claims, I will leave them aside for present and return to them. Okay, so this is just a claim as it stands. Okay, it's just a claim as it stands that this is the case. Nobody really has put any legs to this. But later on, we're going to come back to this. Okay? But for the time being, I'm going to leave it here, and it's going to be answered in basically a little more technical discussion, basically the same way I've already answered it. And that is the uniqueness proof is that is it indeed Christianity and the non-Christian world that are at odds. And that when we prove the non-Christian worldview, we've established Christianity. In other words, we do have a disjunction of two contradictory propositions. Okay, and I'm going to try to show this, why this has to be the case later on, and it's going to have to do with the nature of the Christian worldview. The nature of the Christian worldview and the nature of the non-Christian worldview is that the non-Christian worldview is essentially in agreement at all points. It denies the Trinity, denies revelation, etc. Okay, now let's move on to objection 3, and then we'll briefly come back to the second objection. So remember, the first objection is what? There is no real, unique, type of argument called transcendental arguments. They are not unique. They're just a version of a straightforward, direct, traditional argument. That's easy to answer. The second criticism is that the transcendental argument offers no uniqueness proof. It may establish that Christianity is a sufficient, this Christianity may be true, but just by disproving other Christian worldviews doesn't do what? Establish the Christian worldview. The answer was twofold. Bring it on. Bring the other one worldview on. That's the practical comeback, right? The practical comeback. That's the one that we'd use in a debate. Right? If I were to debate an atheist and trounce them, not that they're going to admit it, but if I debated an atheist and trounced them and he did admit it, you know, he said, well, maybe something else is true. You know, I would love that, right? You just laugh and say, well, what is it? Right? That's very rhetorically powerful. But that doesn't answer the theoretical question. Maybe there is a possible worldview out there. Okay, and maybe they can't think of it. Well, if that's a theoretical possibility, we have not offered a uniqueness proof. The way to offer the uniqueness proof is to show that is Christianity versus non-Christianity, and one of them has to be true. And if you disprove non-Christianity, you've established Christianity. Okay, the third objection has to do with the mere sufficiency of the Christian worldview. The mere sufficiency of the Christian worldview. A criticism of TAG that has been around for some time is that while TAG demonstrates the sufficiency of the Christian worldview to account for human experience, it does not demonstrate the necessity of the Christian worldview. Okay, what is a sufficient condition and what is a necessary condition? Well, a necessary condition for fire, for example, let me think of something else. A necessary condition for the modus tollendo ponens, which is basically the just disjunctive syllogism. A necessary condition of that is that the law is a law of non-contradiction. Or take just simply modus tollens, is the law of non-contradiction. Without the law of non-contradiction, you cannot get modus tollens, right? If P, then Q, not Q, therefore, not P. If you don't have the law of non-contradiction, you can't have that. It's a necessary condition of that. But it is not a sufficient condition. Just because you have the law of non-contradiction, it doesn't imply modus tollens. Okay, so it is a necessary but non-sufficient condition. Now, the other way, this criticism is that what you've done is show that Christianity is a sufficient condition for human intelligibility, but not a necessary condition. Meaning that it is sufficient. It will give you all you need for you to understand human experience, to make sense of it. But just because it's a sufficient condition doesn't mean it is necessary. Right? It is a sufficient condition to have fire, to have oxygen, a match, and, you know, low humidity, say, and terrestrial conditions, and friction that comes at a certain rate. That is a sufficient condition to produce a fire. But is that a necessary condition to produce fire? Well, of course not. You don't need a match to produce fire. Lightning will do it, right, if it strikes a dry tree. We can use some more primitive means of lighting fires. You can use a lighter. You can turn on the gas with the ignition. There's many things that will start a fire. You don't need a match. A match, given all those other conditions, is a sufficient condition to light a fire, but it's not a necessary condition. So this contention here is, okay, what you've done is shown that Christianity is sufficient to explain and account for human experience. But what you haven't done is shown that it is a necessary precondition. Before moving to the objection itself, it's important to first understand the distinction. Oh, I could have just read this and explained it to you. Okay, we'll forget that. Turning back to the objection, the opponent contend that even when it is granted that the existence of God is a sufficient condition for human experience, this does not prove that it is a necessary condition. Thus far, this objection is the same as objection 2. Notice the similarity. The difference, however, is that whereas objection 2 merely asserted the possibility of a worldview other than Christianity that could provide the preconditions of human experience, proponents of this objection claim that while there is no actual worldview, such as naturalism or Islam, that accounts for human experience. They do claim to have invented one that can, like Christianity, account for human experience. What then is this worldview? So there are people that have come up with the worldview that some of them claim to be Vantillians, and they say that they are Vantillians, but Vantil has a problem here. We like his transcendental argument, but it only provides sufficient conditions. Not because it hasn't defeated other worldviews, but because it has only proved to be sufficient. And we can come up with worldviews that do provide the preconditions for human experience, and so show that there's more than one. There's more than one worldview that show the necessary preconditions. This invented worldview is said to be identical to Christianity, except for the fact that it differs from it in one or more particular points of doctrine. This made-up worldview may, for example, hold all things in common with Christianity, except that where Christianity teaches the doctrine of a Trinity. Now, this is where it's going to get silly, but stay with me. Whereas Christianity teaches the doctrine of a Trinity, this other worldview, call it Christianity, asserts a quadrinity, one God in four persons. Everything else, the doctrine of revelation, salvation, and so on, is the same as the Christian worldview. Now, this is them speaking, not me. So don't throw tomatoes at me. That's what they say. Okay, so here it is. We can come up with a non-Christian worldview that will explain everything that Christianity explains, but is not Christianity. If we can do that, what have we done? We have shown that it is only, Christianity is merely a sufficient, not a necessary precondition to human intelligibility. Now this is, if it were true, this would be a good criticism. Now, the people that make this criticism don't claim that Christianity is true. They just say that, look, you say that you can disprove all things and establish Christianity. Well, we agree with you that there's nothing actual that can sufficiently establish the human experience. But we can invent one. It's going to be just like Christianity, but we're going to change it at one or two points. And since Christianity, the idea is, since Christianity does explain the world, explain human experience, then so must this view be able to explain the world. Bonson's response to this objection is helpful, but I don't think completely adequate. He contends that this type of worldview merely apes the Christian worldview and as such is completely dependent upon it. That is, because this worldview has its intellectual origination in Christianity, is not a legitimate competitor of the Christian worldview. Now, this is in some sense right. Right, it's obviously just a fraudulent view. Right? It's not a serious view. And so Bonson says is that this is just aping Christianity. It's aping Christianity, and so it's not a real competitor. Moreover, he maintains that it is the entire Christian worldview that proves the necessary preconditions of human experience, not just a portion of it. The Christian worldview is a complete and organic, as a complete and organic system is what is necessary. Proponents of this criticism retort that while it may be true that Christianity is a knockoff of Christianity, the origin of this position is not relevant. Just because Christianity is an invention that just so happens to be intellectually dependent upon Christianity does not mean it does not pose a challenge to Tagg. Tagg, after all, claims to establish that Christianity is the necessary precondition of human experience. The Christian worldview hypothesis is only an attempt to show that while Christianity may indeed be a sufficient precondition, it is not necessary. Christianity, so it is maintained, is also a sufficient condition. Christianity thus supposedly exposes the spurious nature of Tagg's conclusion. As for Bonson's other claim that it is the entire Christian worldview that is necessary, proponents of the Christianity objection reply that this is a claim, not a proof. Okay? It's a claim, not a proof. Bonson says this is the whole Christian worldview, every component of it is necessary. So if you take any part of it away, the whole thing collapses. And what they say is that that's a claim, not a proof. It is not enough to assert that the complete Christian worldview and only the complete Christian worldview is a necessary precondition for experience. Okay, so what is our reply here? Well, we'll come back to this again too, but Bonson is right. on two points, right? This is an aping of Christianity. It's dependent upon Christianity, but the comeback is, so what? We're just playing with this. You're making a claim of necessity. We're saying, no, it's only sufficient. We can come up with one here. Bonson's other objection is that if you take any element of Christianity and change it, then what? Then you no longer provide the preconditions for human experience. And the comeback there is what? That's a claim. That's not a argument. That's a claim, not an argument. Well, Bonson is right, and all I'm going to do is show that his claim, and it's more than a claim, but his claim is right. But we do have to unpack it a little bit. Okay, so you understand this argument. Okay, we can come up with this view that is just like Christianity, only change one point, and that can do it as well. And Bonson's point is, no, you can't change any part of the Christian worldview. By the way, I'm going to give you a criticism of this from one point of view, but right now from another point of view, the answer to this, from one level, is that if you change Christianity at any point, Christianity will fail to be a sufficient condition to human intelligibility. Why is that? If you change Christianity at any point, Christianity, I'm not talking about Christianity, which just takes as a given that you're just changing to one point, but Christianity, if you change it at any point, fails to provide the necessary preconditions of human experience. Why is that true? Because every word that proceeds from the mouth of God is true. Right? Everything that God reveals is true. And if one of them was changed, anything that God revealed, anything about the Christian worldview was changed at any point, that would show what? That God doesn't speak the truth, or that there's a tension somewhere in the system, and if there's a contradiction in your system, you've done what? You've shown it as false. So one of the interesting things to say about this is if you change Christianity at any point, you have undermined the Christian worldview's ability to provide the necessary preconditions. Now, I'm speaking idealistically, right? As far as we are in church history and sanctified doctrinally, we still believe that there's going to be learning and more knowledge delved out of the Bible, right? We believe in sanctification through church history. So I'm not talking about our theology as it stands now. I'm talking about idealized Christian theology. But idealized Christian theology, true Christian theology, if anything were changed at that one single point, all Christianity would be false because God would be a liar. So we've got to remember this. But their objection is not that we change Christianity. It's that we change something in Christianity and call it something totally different. Yeah, I know this is silly, but stay here, bear with me. Bear with me. Okay, we'll come back to this objection in a moment. Objection 4 is the move from conceptual necessity to necessary existence. Conceptual necessity to necessary existence. The final objection is perhaps the most uncommon, but the infrequent use of this objection should not mislead the opponent of TAG into thinking that it is not a serious consequence. It is probably the most powerful argument against TAG and the most difficult to answer. One thing that's telling is a lot of the opponents of the transcendental argument of God's existence don't have a blood instinct. I don't think they have a killer instinct because they don't typically use this argument. In fact, I know of nobody writing now that uses this argument except in secular philosophical literature. But I think it is the most serious criticism. Not that it is a valid criticism or a strong criticism, but it's the most serious of all the ones that we've covered so far. And the criticism here is dependent upon a distinction. And the distinction is this. Just because we have to, in order to make sense of the world, presuppose the Christian worldview, that, so it is claimed, does not entail that the God of the Bible actually exists. Now, why is that? Well, we've got to draw a distinction between conceptual necessity and ontological necessity. If I'm going to make sense of my world and I have to think about the world, if I'm going to think about it in a way that makes sense of it, if I have to think of it in a Christian way, that proves the conceptual necessity of Christianity. I can't get away from that. If I want to make sense of the world, if I want to be rational, I want to have science, I have to presuppose the Christian worldview. And what's the Christian worldview? Well, it's a philosophical system, right? Some philosophers may call it a conceptual scheme, some way of conceptualizing your experience. You have to have a certain way of viewing things. Call it a paradigm, call it a language game, a way of life, worldview, perspective, whatever you want to call it, web of belief. You have to have this one, Christianity, in order to make sense of everything. Now, the objection is, just because you have to think this way doesn't mean the world is actually that way. Now, some of you that have a smattering of philosophy or have more than a smattering, this sounds like an objection that would come from what vein in history of philosophy? Conceptual ways you have to think and the way the world may or may not really be. That sounds like who? Platon. Well, somewhat like Platonism. But I'm thinking more of a Enlightenment philosopher, Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant. It sounds like a Kantian criticism. And some of it is motivated by studies on Kant, right? I mean, what is the typical way of explaining Kant? Well, you have a way that you have to conceptualize the world, right? Not forcing you to in terms of I come to this conclusion, but we just think of the world this way, and that is called what? The way you sense the world, experience the world, is the phenomena, but the way the world really is the noumena, right? The way the world really is the noumena. And because of our preconditions, because of the way we think, because of the way that we have to approach the world, we can never get to the noumena. So we may have to think of the world as being in a spatio-temporal continuum. If you want to think of an object, we have to think of it as being in space and in time. That doesn't mean, according to this reading of Kant, that the object of your experience, if indeed there is an object of your experience outside of your experience, this is, remember, after Kant, who comes along? The idealists, right? Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, they come and say, well, we're just going to cut it off. We don't need the noumena. All we need is the phenomena. That's why we have the phenomenology of spirit in Hegel. It's cutting off the noumenal realm, but that comes later. But assuming there is an object of our experience doesn't mean just because we experience something in a spatial, temporal way, doesn't mean that object really is in a spatial, temporal environment or situation. Doesn't mean it exists in space. Doesn't mean it exists in time. Okay. Does this make sense? Okay, the argument again is that just because you have to think of the world a certain way doesn't mean the world really is that way. Some feedback. Is this understand completely, not understand at all? Some feedback. So I'll go over this again if it will be helpful. I know, almost dinner time. Just get on with it already. Okay. So that is the objection. Or that leads to setting up the objection. So that's the setup. And the argument is, look, you've proved one, but you haven't established the other. Now, what is the transcendental argument trying to establish? Well, we've been a little bit sloppy, in one sense, so far this week. We talk about proving what? The Christian worldview. And we talk about what? Proving God's existence. Well, this objection is saying, well, those are two different things. They're not the same thing. You can prove the Christian worldview as something that's necessary to have in order to make sense of the world, but you haven't proved the God of the Bible. In other words, something, an entity, a being. You've proved a theory, but you haven't proved that there is something that answers to that theory. Okay, so this is the objection. Bonson's response to this criticism is, like objection 3 above, not totally adequate, I don't think. He contends that because this is an apologetic dialogue, this is a quote from Dr. Bonson, giving reasons, expecting arguments, etc., both parties have assumed that the true viewpoint must affirm rationality. Vantil argues that if the unbeliever's worldview were true, rationality would be repudiated, whereas if Christianity were true, rationality would be affirmed and required. So while the whole argument may be stated in hypothetical terms, the conclusion is actually established as true since the hypothetical condition was granted from the outset by both parties. If the unbeliever realizes this and now refuses to grant the legitimacy, demand, or necessity of rationality, he has stepped outside the boundary of apologetics. Furthermore, he forfeits the right to assert or believe that he has repudiated rationality, since without rationality, assertion and belief are unintelligible. Okay, so it's a good answer up to a point. Good answer. What is his comeback to this? His comeback is, if you stake this claim, if you say, well, yes, Christianity is the preconditions for rationality, but that doesn't mean it's true. It means you have to believe it, but it doesn't mean it's true. Then his comeback is, well, you're no longer being rational, right? You're no longer playing the reason-giving game, and you're no longer subject to being answered, right? If you give up rationality, say maybe it doesn't, God doesn't exist, which means by implication Christian worldview is false, even though you have to think of it as true, then Bronson's comeback is you're not being rational at that point, and you've given up the reason-giving game, and therefore debate's over with, right? Remember what we talked about earlier. What do you say to somebody who says, I don't believe in God? Well, what's your position? I don't have a position. What do you, what do you believe in? Nothing. And somebody's, it's not possible, but somebody who really has given up reason, given up rationality, apologetics is not going to do you any good, right? Apologetics is the reasoned defense of the faith. So Bronson is right about that. If they give up reason, then apologetically, we've answered them. That's it. There's nothing more to be said. But Bronson's answer is that this is, let me go back here. Bronson's answer is that this issue is one of rationality. If Tank established that Christianity is the necessary conceptual precondition of human experience, including rationality, it follows that we must hold to the Christian worldview in order to be rational. And if somebody refuses to accept the Christian worldview or God's existence, he has no foundation for rationality, and without such a foundation, has no rational basis to object to the conclusion of Tagg. This defense carries a great deal of force. It effectively undermines the unbeliever's ability to rationally reject the Christian faith. Now, that's pretty powerful, isn't it? And one of the things we've got to say about this criticism is, if this is all that is left, the opponent's in pretty bad position, isn't he? Because this criticism comes down to this. You've defeated everything. You've shown that we must believe in Christianity. But that doesn't mean that God exists. Well, let's say that as it stands, that's true. I'm going to criticize that later. But let's just say that's true. What kind of criticism is that? Right? You've shown to me that in order to be rational, I have to be a Christian. But maybe reality isn't rational. Maybe Christianity is not true, and there's some possibility out there that nothing is true, we live in chaos. Okay? Maybe we have to believe in Christianity to be rational, but I'm willing to give up rationality. What would Greg Bronson say about that? Right? Well, this is one of his famous statements. Speaking to the microphone, right? Come up here and tell that to the world. We give up rationality. If we wanted it, we'd have to be Christians, but we've decided to be irrational. Okay, if that's the best argument they have against Tagg, then they are in desperate straits. Okay. Nevertheless, there is something to this argument because we claim as presuppositionalists that we're not just proving the mere conceptual necessity of Christianity. We're proving God exists. Right? So we want to answer this objection. Even though, apologetically, once they're at this objection, they're on their last leg. There's nothing left. There's nothing left for them. But for us, we're not just interested in talking about conceptual necessity or merely conceptual necessity. We're out to vindicate the existence of God. So there's something to this criticism, even though you're in desperate straits if you're forced to make this criticism. This defense carries weight. It effectively undermines the unbeliever's ability to rationally reject the Christian faith. But notice that this defense construes Tagg not so much as a proof for God's existence, but a proof for the necessity of believing the Christian worldview. The problem with this is that although Christianity may be the necessary precondition for experience, it does not follow from this that Christianity is true. Okay, so that is the punchline of it, and we do need to deal with that. Yet this objection is valid. If there is something to this objection, then we must say that though we must believe in Christianity, it doesn't follow that Christianity is true. So we need to answer these objections. This, by the way, is a good point to break if we want to take our break now.